Hello and welcome to the Swamp Flicks Lanyap podcast, a show where the three of us who are friends, who are in different states, time zones, and states of mind, gather to discuss one particular film and also, you know, catch up on other things that we have been watching.
I am Brandon, and I am a Taurus. No, I'm not a Taurus. I was just thinking of that B-52's song just now. Like, it'd be fun to call out what state you're from, you know? My name's Brandon. I'm in Louisiana, and I am a Cancer. And I like long walks on the beach.
Allie?
Huh?
Oh, yeah, I am Allie. I'm a Virgo, and I like terrible books.
And I am Boomer. I reside in Redacted, and I am a Gemini. Okay, I live in Austin, Texas, and I am a Gemini. Don't hold that against me. Although recently I was able to do some interstate travel. I went to Denver for a wedding, and because it's a long drive and I don't trust Boeing aircraft, I bought a ticket, saw it was a Boeing, and then immediately got a refund so that instead I could drive myself. And I said, well, what's halfway between Austin and Denver? And the internet said Amarillo. And then I looked up Amarillo motels and discovered that the Big Texan Motel, which is adjacent and next door to the Big Texan Steak Ranch, is in Amarillo. So I decided to go ahead and stay there because the hotel looks like it's done up to look like the front of a Western frontier town, like, you know, from the movies, and I guess presumably possibly from real life. I will say that as I drove across this nation of ours and I saw all of the little towns that had been completely destroyed by the interstate, I came to realize that it's not the stars and stripes, which should be the flag of America. The true flag of our nation is sun-bleached, tattered plastic wrapped around a barbed wire fence and fluttering in the wind. So if you're ever out there, if you're out there listening in that part of America, we love you. And we really wish that your antique stores were still open. You may have heard of the Big Texan because there is a scene from the film Waking Up in Reno, which I have never seen and I'm not going to see. But Billy Bob Thornton's character in this movie attempts to take on the 72-ounce steak challenge, which you've probably seen it parodied in King of the Hill in the episode They Call It Bobby Love, or even in the season 10 episode of The Simpsons, if you got that far, the episode Maximum Homer Drive, which is the one where Homer becomes a trucker, and he tries to do the 72-ounce steak. I did not attempt to eat the 72-ounce steak at the Big Texan like Billy Bob Thornton, Homer, and Bobby Hill. I could do it. I could do the steak. I actually have no doubts about that. But you don't just eat the steak. You also have to eat the potato, the roll, the salad, and a shrimp cocktail containing three shrimp.
Jeez.
And I would not be able to consume all of those things in the hour that you are provided.
I feel like the potato is the killer, right? That's the deal.
Yeah, yeah, that's the heavy hitter there.
And the salad, because salad takes a while for me. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that would be a real speed bump.
Okay, but you got to eat that first, and then it squishes down because it's leaves.
Well, I'm assuming we're not talking about a leafy green. I assume we're talking about like an iceberg wedge or something. Like
something like that.
They'll probably make you work for it.
I sent you the photo of the sample, because when you go into the lobby of the place, because it's got the big restaurant, which looks just like Sugarfoot's, according to everyone I sent the photo to.
Yep, and confirm.
And they, you know, they also have like, you know, a waiting area and a gift shop. It's kind of like a real country, what's the place with the chicken fried steak and the porch and the giant Checkers?
Are you talking about Cracker Barrel?
Yeah, I am talking about Cracker Barrel. It's like a Cracker Barrel that's on like a very specific theme where it has like toys and games and a waiting area and a gift shop as well.
Can I say what I was mortified by in those pictures?
Please do.
Just the fact that not only do you have to eat the steak in an hour, but they put you on display in the center of the room. You are on stage. You are the entertainment for other diners who will watch in amusement while you puke half your meal up when you are rushing to finish at the end.
I don't think there's anything more American than that.
It's a spectator sport.
I was entertained. Because there, you know, I'm going to go ahead and tip my hand here and admit that I actually ended up staying at the Big Texan Motel and going to the Big Texan Steakhouse twice, because that's where I stopped in the middle of my journey, both to and from Denver. And there was no one eating the Big Texan steak whenever I went there on Thursday night, but there was someone there eating it Sunday evening. And then while she was attempting to eat it, two other people joined her on the raised dais, where you are timed. Once you get up there, there's a man who comes out and he explains the challenge to the entire restaurant, and then he sets the clock, and there you go.
Insane. Is this place named after Big Tex, the giant doll they bring out to the state fair every year? Because the branding seemed Big Tex adjacent to me.
I don't know. It's sort of a chicken and the egg thing.
Okay.
I feel like maybe they came into existence at the same time.
They should kiss.
Oh goodness. This was the least romantic I've ever felt after eating a meal, which is funny because I was on my way to a wedding, and at the wedding we were talking about how isn't it just wonderful how weddings make everyone horny? Like, isn't that wonderful? I will say, once I got to Denver, I realized that I am a fool because I didn't bring a coat or a jacket. I was like 2 hours out from Denver and driving through the snow.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I've got my Birkenstocks on. Like, this is actually going to be a problem when I arrive.
Was it an outdoor wedding?
No, it was indoor.
Okay. There is at least that.
But once I got to Denver and couldn't go out, even though that was my plan to go out the night that I got there to the bars and check out the scene, instead, because I had no coat, I went ahead and watched a movie that I had put on my phone specifically to watch on this trip, which was Torch Song Trilogy. And nice. I watched it lying in bed in a hostel in Denver, in the way that Harvey Fierstein would have wanted, on my phone, constantly having to swipe away app notifications while I was trying to just engage with this beautiful story. But you'll hear more about my thoughts on that in the upcoming publication of our discussion of that film in Swampflix's Movie of the Month on swampflix.com. One of the most exciting things that happened while I was on the road was I got a text message from you, Brandon, saying that Vera Drew, who wrote, directed, and starred in The People's Joker, had responded to our link to our review of it. That's the other thing that I've seen since we met last. And that review went up over a week ago, I think. But Vera Drew has responded to it, and she seems to have been touched by our love of it. Or at
she
least
appreciated your tears, that you were moved to tears by it. She acknowledged those tears and seemed genuinely Aww. Appreciative of it. She does appear to have like a Matt Farley-esque like Google alert system going up where she's actively engaging with people who respond to her film, which is really lovely and really speaks to its like outsider art quality as well.
Yeah, and the fact that she's doing this now, because if her career takes off from this as it should, she is not going to have time to engage with the little people in the future. So that was really nice.
Speaking of Simpson, she'll have that Ringo Starr effect where she's responding to letters and tweets like 20 years later.
But yeah, that's what I have been up to. Allie, what have you been watching?
I watched the Douglas Sirk Noir Lured. It's got Lucille Ball in it, wow. And she's brilliant. And yeah, so it's about this, like, she's a dancer, and there's been a bunch of dancers going missing and not being found. And the person who is kidnapping them is leaving notes and poetry behind. And one of her friends is a girl who goes missing, and she ends up getting like deputized to help solve the crime. It is great. It's got, what is his name? George Sanders, he was the critic in
All About Eve.
Yes, he is the critic in All About Eve. Our manipulative gay husband.
Love that bitch.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
So, you know, he is great in it. Lucille Ball is beautiful in it. You know, it's a fun movie. And I was surprised, like, I wouldn't have guessed the ending at first. There's that point in which you're like, oh no, is it this person? It, kind of like noirs do. But yeah, I enjoyed it because, you know, Boomer, you pointed out a while ago that we talk about Douglas Sirk more than anybody, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I had only ever seen his melodramas. So it was interesting to see him do sort of like a crime noir. And it's just as fun. Maybe not as good, but like, it's still like worth watching.
It's kind of hard when you're like the master of an art form to like dabble in something else.
Yeah.
You know, like, when he
I
makes melodramas, it's like as
on
good as movies
in his
get.
Movies, though. Early oh, okay. on in his career, though. So, you know, this is pre-melodrama. The master of the melodrama making a noir it's fun. Like, especially if you're like me and you love Lucille Ball. Like, she's just so good in it. I also, unlike many other people who I've seen on the internet talking about it, I have been absolutely enjoying Criterion 24/7.
All right, explain what this is.
Okay, so Criterion has done this thing 24/7. You know how Shudder has the thing where you can just turn on
there,
what's on Shudder
that's
now?
What I wanted to talk about. Shudder, yeah. Tubi, Pluto TV. There's so many streaming apps that have been doing this for years.
I know.
They have like
I know.
A continuous, basically like a live broadcast.
Okay,
quote unquote.
But here's the thing. Is Criterion doesn't tell you what's on.
I don't know that the other people do either.
No, if you go to Shudder, it like
it'll
on
say
the
what's
front
next.
Page, yeah, it'll say what's on, like playing at the moment. But Criterion doesn't tell you what's playing at the moment.
Oh, that's
it doesn't
wild.
Tell you. Yeah, it doesn't tell you what's going to be on next. You kind of just can jump into a movie. And yeah, Thomas and I have been kind of loving it and joking about how it's kind of like TV in the 80s, except it's like Criterion movies. So the other night, I ended up turning it on and caught all of Eraserhead. And this is like a rewatch for me. And I really like it. I forgot how good the puppets are in Eraserhead. I don't think I need to give a summary of Eraserhead other than the fact that like it's very hard to summarize.
I would love to revisit it soon because when I saw that, it was like very early in like, oh, I should see more movies that aren't just, you know, junky horror films that I grew up with.
Yeah.
And I was not ready for that movie in high school. I like thought of it as being very pretentious and like a lot of shots of just a guy walking around these like industrial spaces.
There,
and you know,
there are.
Now having like, you know, the benefit of 25 years of watching a wider range of movies, it's like I have more context for what it's like to make an independent film with like no budget and just like leave a lasting mark that loud on the cultural landscape with like those few resources. I feel like I'd probably appreciate it a lot more now than I did as
I was
a teenager.
Gonna say I know that you're kind of picky about your Lynch.
I like it when he behaves. I mean, I love like The Elephant Man and like Wild at Heart, stuff that looks recognizable.
Yeah, so I think you'll like it, especially given the practical effects and the puppets.
Yeah.
They're just so good. The baby is just incredible. I forgot how much of the movie the baby is in. I thought it was one of those, like, used sparingly puppets, but no. No, the baby's in so much more of the movie than I remember, and it's beautiful. I love it. And I've always kind of loved Eraserhead, like, from the beginning. So, I mean, and I'm less picky about my Lynch than you, but I also, Wild at Heart. No, it's either Wild at Heart or Mulholland Drive is my favorite.
See, I didn't love that one in high school either. I
you
am picky,
it
I guess.
Since, though?
No, I need a revisit.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Yeah.
That one for sure.
I just never know who to trust because everyone loves Twin Peaks The Return. I think it's unwatchable. But, you know, teach their own, I guess.
Yeah.
I do want to pause on this Criterion thing, though.
Yeah.
It is cool that they're doing it. My sticking point is more just like the sudden excitement around it when like every other streamer has been doing that for so long. It's just very odd that like people are citing it as like this new invention in...
Yeah, it's like, not.
Streaming presentation. It really isn't.
Yeah, I think the most notable thing is that they don't tell you what you're watching. And I love that. And I know a lot of people have complained about it on the internet. And I've just been like, No, this is perfect. Please don't tell me. Just let me walk into something weird.
I do think there's like a Twitter account now that's like tweeting out what's playing on there. If you're like that upset about it, you can find it.
Yeah, and I'm the opposite of upset. I am overjoyed. I love being able to turn on my TV and have weird Criterion shit without warning. It's been a hit in this household. I caught the end, or not quite the end. It was maybe the last third of the Rolling Stones at Altamont by the Maisels.
Bad vibes.
Bad vibes, but good documentary style. Like, I had never seen it before, so I was like, wow. And I didn't realize it was the Maisels, so I was like, whoa, there's a lot of
you
things
can see
here.
Little Edie bobbing her head in the background if you squint hard enough.
Yeah, right? And, you know, a random salesman hawking Bibles. Yeah, I had never seen it before. Kind of somehow forgot that it had existed. But yeah, it was interesting. But besides watching Criterion movies just randomly, whatever's on, which is, yeah, been happening, I watched The House on Telegraph Hill. So it's another sort of noir. It's also on Criterion, because Criterion has this collection of what they're calling like gothic noirs that have like a lot of like vague gothic settings and all of this stuff. It's been a fun genre watch for me. So House on Telegraph Hill follows this woman who is a Polish immigrant who was in a concentration camp, and she gets freed from the camp, but she had a friend who died who had family in San Francisco, and she steals her friend's who died's identity so she can go to America and be part of this family. And also she's gonna take care of her friend's son, so it's not entirely like selfish, but it is. And so she's kind of racked with the guilt of that, and she gets married to like her friend's like cousin by marriage while she's there, and he thinks that she's the friend. Anyway, there's a lot of like mistaken identity stuff going on, and slowly she realizes that there's like some sort of sinister plot against her and the child going on. And so she is trying to convince everybody to take her seriously. And she's got like this minor love interest who is the U.S. I think he's a major who helped free the camp she was in, that she happens to run into. I don't know. It's a really interesting movie. It's kind of a little bit of a mess. It kind of feels a little bit like U.S. propaganda-y in like the military way of like, oh, look at this good military guy, he freed the person in the camps and now he's here and helping her out in America, and he doesn't care that she lied about her identity because of course, like, who could blame her for wanting a better life, and you know, that sort of pro-US sentiment, which is, yeah, I don't know, it's weird. And, you know, the child in the movie is really kind of, like, bizarre and uncanny in a way. Like, just the way he speaks is very, golly, mister! So, yeah, I don't know if I recommend it as much as I recommend Lured.
I'm surprised to see who directed it, now I'm looking at it. Robert Wise, who has a very strange career where he has done a classic gothic noir, if you want to call it that, but The Haunting.
Oh, I love The Haunting.
Yeah, like one of the best movies ever made.
One of my favorites, yeah.
But he's also just done a wide range of stuff, like some sci-fi stuff, like The Day the Earth Stood Still, another classic. But
yeah.
Also, and I'm not going to ring the bell because I'm bringing it up myself, but Star Trek The Motion Picture is among his credits.
Which, you know, many Star Trek people don't like.
Right.
I find it average.
He's kind of like a, you know, classic workman, old Hollywood mm-hmm. director that just like did whatever came across his desk, and sometimes it was like a knockout and sometimes it wasn't.
Yeah.
But he just kept working and, you know, did competent work even when it wasn't brilliant.
Yeah.
It's an older style of filmmaking that's gone away.
I mean, he probably got that Star Trek contract based solely on The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes.
Which he can do sci-fi.
Unbelievable classic, but
love that movie.
Yeah, I do love that movie as well.
It is funny thinking about Tarantino announced this week that he's canceling his next picture because he's like getting really hung up on what his 10th and final film is going to be for this like perfect filmography or whatever. Yeah. But this Robert Wise filmography is like the exact kind of thing he idolizes in older filmmakers. And that guy just kind of made whatever for 40 years straight, you know?
Yeah. For all of Tarantino's love of like schlock and like weird, whatever grindhouse shit, like he is pretentious.
Yeah. He's a little precious about his own work.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's just some great irony. So yeah, that's what I've been watching is some Criterion 24/7, some classic noirs. It's been a good time around here. It's been chill. Brendan, what have you been watching?
I could report on a few new releases. I'm going to go from like the least to most significant. I caught up with Drive Away Dolls now that it's on Peacock. I missed it when it was in theaters.
I'm excited to hear what you think.
I think that your review was very kind and generous to what might be the worst new release I've seen so far this year.
Yeah, thank you. I was trying not to be cruel, even though in my heart it called to me.
Yeah, I would love to see a lesbian crime caper from a Coen brother about stolen dildos and, you know, the subject matter and the tone of it, that kind of like flippant Scooby-Doo scampering around and just avoiding the criminals or like hot on your tails. Like, that sounded fun to me. If I were in a theater and I heard that Yosemite Sam voice come out of Margaret Qualley, I very much might have walked out of the first movie of my life.
Like, really?
I might have bolted out of the theater. I don't get her. I've seen her headline two movies now, like, the other one was Sanctuary, where she played a dominatrix and she had Christopher Abbott locked in a hotel room. She was awful in that, too. What is going on?
Yeah, I don't know. I've actually had that thought multiple times where I'm like, whose daughter is she?
Well, she's Andy McDowell's daughter, which partly explains the accent. But her Texas accent in this movie is so embarrassing. I had a fight or flee moment at home, even. And the only way I could get through the movie was by folding laundry through it. And I can't say it was worth sticking around for. There may be a couple scenes of flashbacks to Geraldine Viswanathan's character's like youthful discoveries of her sexuality, where she's like in her backyard spying on a naked neighbor, that I thought were like interesting.
Yeah.
And that's about where it starts and stops for me.
Yeah, there is something really interesting about that, where it's like, you know, she is remembering that her sort of sexual awakening came from observing this like sort of nude sunbathing neighbor and who wore cowboy boots. And that has sort of like clearly influenced what her sexual desires are, even if she doesn't realize it, especially if she doesn't realize it. And that is probably the most interesting thing that's happening in there. But yeah, I mean, it's not like, everything that you're saying is absolutely true. It seems like it ought to work. It's so close to working, but it comes so close, but not in a way that is satisfactory. There are a lot of comedies where I'm like, that was almost funny enough to be one of the greats. But it's just that this one never quite gets far enough to actually be funny. And I think that it's because it's just one of them. Like, it genuinely feels like it's missing a Coen brother, because it is.
I think it has a real Apple TV Plus feel to it, by which I mean it is a phony fucking movie that, like, doesn't feel like it actually exists. And yet I've seen the evidence. I've watched the whole thing. Yeah, they really need to get back together or something. Or take a break. I don't know. One of the two.
Let somebody else direct a movie for a while. Just give them your money.
Yeah. But I did see two movies I enjoy, though. I got the negativity out of the way up front. I saw that movie Sasquatch Sunset, which looks like, looks like a phony movie.
I want to see it so bad.
It looks fake, but yeah. It also exists. This is a movie where four actors are in prosthetic makeup as Sasquatches in the woods. And the entire film is just them wandering around. They're kind of half-assedly searching for more Sasquatches by like banging these sticks on trees and like calling out for like potential mates, but that's not really like a solid mission. Like, most of their day is just like picking fleas off of each other, shitting Eating living mushrooms and getting high off that. Just kind of staring at the sky. One of them is trying to self-improve by learning how to count higher than three, and he can't quite get to four and gets very frustrated about it.
Oh, boy.
There's no dialogue in this movie. It's all grunts. Their Amazing. Genitals are just kind of hanging out, and they have these, like, really embarrassing needle dicks that get erect several times whenever they get excited. It's like if a throwaway joke from Everything Everywhere All at Once, like this is like one alternate universe and one of those like quick half second flashes. If like one of those got developed into its own movie, but like the commitment to the bit is pretty impressive. Like the fact that they don't bring in human characters to observe this behavior and be like, wow, look how goofy that is. Get a load of these cryptid goofballs. So it never breaks character. And also, as goofy as it is, like watching these Sasquatches who are basically hairy idiots with their genitals hanging out, like there is humor to their behavior. And there's a lot of good visual gags, I think, that like actually made me laugh. But what I really found impressive about the movie is that it doesn't overload every minute with another gag. Like there's a lot of breathing room where they're just existing, and the movie gives you a lot of time to think because they're just sitting around trying to think and not doing a particularly good job of it. But it just reminds me of the few times I get now, usually during hurricane power outages, where there's just like unstructured free time and I'm not supposed to be at a job or working on my hobby or, you know, keeping my familial bonds strong, and then I'm just like allowed to sit in my environment, and how like guilty of a pleasure that is sometimes. Like it takes infrastructural failure for me to just like exist. And I found myself, as my mind was invited to wander, just like thinking about like how I wish I was just dumb and naked in the woods with no particular goal for my day except feeding myself and finding a place to sleep.
That's really like the millennial condition, I think. Like if we were to describe it, yeah, there's that deep-rooted desire.
It's a weirdly sincere movie. I don't know. It seems like it's like just a joke, and I think that would be the easiest way to go, is to do like the Geico caveman route, where you're just like constantly goofing on these guys. But I mean, they take it kind of sincerely. Like two of the main actors are Jesse Eisenberg and Riley Keough, and you would never know that if you didn't stay till the end credits. Like there's no vanity in their performances. They're just one of the Sasquatches, and they take it as this like sincere acting exercise. Like, how do I act purely primal? And it's weirdly compelling.
Yeah, I really want to see that. And partially because that would mean that like both the new releases I've seen this year are just people in animal suits.
What was the other one?
Hundreds of Beavers.
Oh yeah, I need to see that soon.
Yeah, it's fun.
And then I did see one I would more broadly recommend. I feel like Sasquatch Sunset is like only for people who've seen that ad and are like, I can do that for 90 minutes. One that I actually think is like, you know, a more substantial piece of art that more people should engage with is called The Beast, from Bertrand Bonello. I don't know if y'all know him. He's like a French filmmaker. Mm-mm. And he's done these like kind of genre films that are all very cold and weird. Like he did this like teenage terrorist movie called Nocturama, where the first half is just these teens in these like really cool hip outfits going around Paris setting up these bombs and all go off at once and like blow up the city, and then they hide out in a shopping mall and get executed by the state in retribution. And then he made another one called Zombie Child that I really liked, that's like set at this French boarding school with this Haitian student who's exploited by the white kids in her class to like use these sort of like Haitian zombie rituals for their kind of petty middle school beef. And it kind of blows up in everyone's face in this like really upsetting way. So he kind of does these genre templates, but from like a weird angle. The Beast is set in the 2040s. It's set in like the near future. An AI has taken over the world and replaced almost all workers. Like it's just completely made the human race unemployable. And part of the way that you can become employable again is by submitting yourself to this process that the AI machines have created, where they quote unquote clean your DNA. They go into your brain and erase all of the trauma from your past lives. And what we see is this character played by Lea Seydoux. She needs a job, so she submits herself to this process. And she hates it. She's like kind of protesting it the whole time because she wants to live in a world where she's still allowed to be like rawly human and emotional. And these AI bots are, you know, trying to drain the last of humanity out of all of us and just make us all emotionless worker drones. And that sounds like a particular kind of movie that this really is not. Mostly what we see is three sections of her past and future lives where I believe in the early 1900s and then in the 2010s and then in the 2040s, she keeps getting romantically linked with this same guy played by George MacKay. And he just ruins everything every single time they hook up. He's just this entitled fuckboy that is always shitty, but the shittiness changes depending on the era they're in. So like, let's say the first section is in the 1910s. That might be a little ahead of where it actually is. It might be just be like 1900. I'm not exactly sure on that. But in that section, he's someone who, you know, catches her eye at a party and is acting overly familiar with her and basically tries to get her to leave her husband, who she loves very much. And in his own kind of entitled way, because he's obsessed with her, he thinks like, I'm entitled to your time and attention, and basically ruins her marriage. In the 2010s, he is an incel and does a lot of like YouTube posting about his hatred for women because he feels like he's done everything right. And, you know, I'm a nice guy. I wear nice clothes. I have a nice car. Why won't anybody fuck me? And it's because he's like a weird Mark Zuckerberg, like loner type who just doesn't know how to relate to people. And he does these really chilling like diary videos about how it's about to be the day of retribution where he gets his revenge on women for rejecting him. And Lea Seydoux happens to be the target of that retribution. And then in the 2040s, he's just like a fellow, like out of work human being who submits himself to the process of being erased, like of being having his DNA cleaned. And the insidiousness of that, I guess, unfolds towards the end. So I don't want to fully spoil that, but it's like very sprawling. I feel like I've seen that kind of storyline before where people fall in love with the same person over and over and over again through the centuries. Like you'll see people, I mean, almost like Everything Everywhere All at Once, not to keep mentioning that movie, but you know, there's like a across time and across the multiverse, we'll always find each other story there. And this is that setup, but it's like how horrifying it would be if that kept happening to you. And it was always like, this fuckboy loser who keeps ruining your life every single time you hook up with him. And the movie kind of, it is scary and weird and like very alienating. It did kind of remind me of Mulholland Drive at some points. Also, you know, Demon Lover came to mind as well. That kind of like chilling futurism. Mm-hmm. But it also has a lot of weird jokes. Like there were parts where I wasn't sure if it was trying to be funny. And then it would show me like clips of Harmony Korine's Trash Humpers as a pop-up ad on a computer, and it's like, well, that is obviously a joke. Like it has like visual gags like that throughout that just sort of undercut the absurdity of all these like social scenarios across time Lea Seydoux keeps ending up in. I think it's a really interesting new release, and I know y'all both have a appreciation for sprawling swing for the fences sci-fi.
We do.
You bet.
This is more in that 2046 style, you know, okay. Like,
yeah,
it's not totally building out this like sci-fi world for you to explore, but it is a drama set within that kind of sprawling, messy, scatterbrained style of sci-fi storytelling across time. And I thought it was really good.
I'm going to track that one down.
That does sound really good. And I love the idea of fated nemesises. I guess that's not really what it is, but
it's so weird because she like keeps falling for it.
Yeah.
Every time she's like, this time it'll be different, which I mean, there is a joke in there about how, mm-hmm. you know, your patterns always play out romantically the same way. Like you will always fall for the same Wile E. Coyote trick every single time. Come to think of it, I guess our main topic is also a fuckboy movie as well.
It is.
In that same category.
It sure is.
We'll be right back.
blame not heaven, but rather a society that tells its youth that the answers can be found in the MTV video games. We must pray that the other teenagers of Sherwood, Ohio, know the name of that righteous dude who can solve their problems. It's Jesus Christ, and he's in the book.
Hello again, listeners. This week, we are talking about my favorite movie. It's a little something called Heathers. It came out in 1989. If you somehow don't know what this movie is, this film stars Winona Ryder as a girl named Veronica Sawyer, who has been a member of the most powerful clique in school known as the Heathers, because the other three girls are all named Heather. Heather McNamara, Heather Duke, and the alpha bitch, Heather Chandler. Over the course of the movie, she meets new boy Jason Dean, who's a bad boy played by Christian Slater, who comes to school and opens her mind to the idea that there could be other ways of getting rid of undesirables in high school. And this is, of course, set against the backdrop of a lot of bullying, a lot of wit, and a high school in which everyone seems to just absolutely and utterly despise each other. I guess that's where we'll start. I will say, you know, we watched All About Eve for our last Lanyap episode, and that's a very quotable movie, but this is the most quotable movie, I think. I watched this alone in preparation for this, even though I didn't need to. I have seen this movie hundreds of times. I gave myself the challenge to be like, could you actually quote this movie in its entirety? And since I was alone, I was able to test that. And I would say about 80% of the dialogue with 99% accuracy. I love this movie. This was not anybody's first time watch, right?
Right.
God, no. I've seen it so many times that I was reluctant to just watch it straight, which I did. But I was much more interested to get into this like thrift store copy of the DVD I have that has a commentary track from the director, the writer, and the producer. And yeah, I learned a lot more about its production this time than I ever have before. It's kind of one of those movies that I saw so early in my like Blockbuster rent video rental days that like it just kind of precedes wanting to know about it. Like, you know, like there are certain bands you never thought to like look up their life story. Like their music just kind of is.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about like how the movie was written and what its intent was and like certain tidbits about it this time that I just never even thought to look up before, because this movie just kind of is, you know, in my DNA from having seen it dozens and dozens of times, especially in the VHS era.
Yeah, there was a time when a very long time ago, 2011, I posted on Facebook, because that was the style at the time, I posted on Facebook that I was about to watch Heathers for the 100th time. And a friend of mine was like, really, the 100th time? And I was like, actually, yeah, probably, at least. And then he photoshopped me into a bunch of Heather's screenshots, which was very funny. And I treasure that memory to this day, when I've probably seen it at least another 20 times in the 15 or so intervening years. I love this movie. I love it.
It's a shame the DVD I have doesn't have a bouncing ball feature where you could just follow along with the script captions in real time, like a karaoke.
Yeah, or like a Disney sing-along tape.
Yeah.
So I don't have as long a history with this movie as y'all, but I love this movie. I actually did not see it until I was an adult, which is, yeah, it feels a little wild because I feel like this would have been one of those movies that had I seen it as a teenager, it would be especially cherished. Like I said, I love this movie, but yeah, it came to me later in life than it had for a lot of people. So, you know, I think it's a little bit of a different experience, maybe.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I will say this movie is formative for me. Formative for like what a movie can be, the baseline of how goofy I want a movie to be and how seriously I want it to take itself. Everything.
What line of dialogue do you think is like most often used in your like daily language? Because I have one that that stuck out to me. It's like, oh, I say that all the time without thinking about it.
This is a real Sophie's choice.
You can say more than one. There's no way to fail the quiz.
Fuck me gently with a chainsaw all the time.
You don't say it though.
No, I mean, kind of. I say maybe. It more than, did you have a brain tumor for breakfast? Which is there another is. One that I think about constantly, but don't often say. What was yours?
Now that I'm thinking about it, I do say, what's your damage, Heather, sometimes, but that's because I have a Heather in my life. Like, that's just her first name. but there's a line when Veronica is furiously writing in her journal, and she says something like, my teenage bullshit has a body count.
My teen angst bullshit has a body count, yes.
And I stole that turn of phrase so many times when I write that I didn't even think about it. But, like, trying to think of a good example, but like let's say the Beast, which I was just talking about before the break, like I'll say like his fuckboy bullshit has a body count. Like I just use that turn of phrase without even considering its source.
Yeah, it's just an idiom mm-hmm. that you use as if it's like a common American language idiom and not yes. just like a quote from Heather's, the most quotable movie of all time.
And one of the things that Daniel Waters mentioned on the commentary track was that he never got compensated for Best Buy stealing the Geek Squad from him. That was like his turn of phrase. That's the table where yeah. the geeks sit in the cafeteria. Is the mm-hmm. he calls that the Geek yeah. Squad.
And then the first one shoots milk out of his nose because Heather A. looks at him.
Yeah. Unfortunately, one of the things I learned was that she did die of a brain tumor later, and she's the one that has the degenerative
yeah,
brain tumor
that's
breakfast.
One of the ironies of the movie.
Yeah. Which is the kind of thing that happens. Like, it's really easy to be flippant and mean when you're young and yes. you don't know people who've died of brain tumors.
Yes.
And then, you know, 20, 30 years later, you're like, oh, that was a little cruel. It was funny. I did land the punchline. But like, now that I know what that real life pain is like, it's a lot harder to joke about it. And I think that's another feat of the writing beyond its quotability mm-hmm. is just like, this walks a very fine line between funny and cruel that so many teen movies in the years since, and like there are a lot of imitators including from Daniel Waters' own brother
own family yeah.
yeah there are a lot of imitators that fall on the wrong side of that divide. A lot of them are too nice, and I can think of a couple that are too mean. Drop Dead Gorgeous and Sugar and Spice, both movies I like, but they're not perfect movies because they don't walk the tightrope as well as this one does. They're just a little too cruel.
Yeah.
It's a feat of tone.
Jawbreaker, I think, is a pretty good
yeah,
example.
It's a little mean. It's a little mean.
You don't think this one's mean?
It is mean, but I don't think it crosses over into being fully unforgivably
yeah.
cruel.
I was going to say it's mean, but in the way that like teens are mean.
Yeah. I'll say the only area where I think that it's really mean in a way that I would understand someone taking offense to now is the constant use of the F slur. Like, it does come up quite a bit. And yeah. I believe that at least one of the Waters brothers is gay. And this movie is like iconic within the queer community because of how witty and funny it is. I do another line that I think about all the time is, I love to suck big dicks. Are you satisfied? Like, I think about that one a lot, too.
That is funny. The I love my dead gay son thing is funny,
yes,
too.
I was going to say, I always guffaw over I love my dead
gay. And I don't think the joke is on the characters who are being called gay. I think, like, ultimately the two jocks who the movie gets revenge on, and then there it even feels sympathy for them after that happens.
Yeah.
You know, there is, like, a balance there where it's like, it's just honest about how homophobic teen boys in a small town would have been in 1988. And yeah. then also, you know, there is like a humanity that cuts through that, like, even though they're homophobic bullies, you know, it doesn't feel good watching their little sister cry at the funeral. But I'm thinking of, like, you know, in Drop Dead Gorgeous, when there's like a bulimia joke, that's just the joke. Like, she is like yeah. so bulimic, she can't function. When there's a bulimia joke in this movie, it's like, how awful is it that someone's being bullied for that in a very flippant way?
Yeah.
The true friend's work is never done.
Yeah. This movie is one of those satires that I'm like, this is a perfect satire. Because it is, like you said, it straddles that line of mean and, like, humanity so well. Like, I have a hard time reading it as even homophobic, because it just feels like that sort of satire of like,
yeah,
this was the attitude and isn't it ridiculous?
Yeah, one of the jokes is that they're planning gay paraphernalia on these two jocks to make it look like a lover suicide, like a double suicide. And one of the objects is a bottle of Evian water.
Come on. Mineral water's come a long way.
But like, the joke is that other people would have that stereotype in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, not really even, you know, our sort of world-weary, world-wise Jason Dean, even he is like, yeah, I got mascara, I guess. I don't know.
A signed photo of Joan Crawford. Fun time.
Yeah. Yes.
While we're on the topic of this scene, I want to call out the unsung heroes, which are the two dumb stoner cops who arrive at the scene. Not in real life, of course. All cops are bastards, but they're very funny in this scene. The way that they're like toking up on the job, and then one of them is like, oh no, I swear I heard a shot that time. And the other one's like, fuck it, let's roll. Like, it's very funny. And,
yes.
And it's you know, in a movie that's been picked apart and picked to death and that I've seen hundreds of times, like, it is so funny to me still. And, you know, what's really, because this is a text that I have pored over and pored over and pored over, like, I love the way that it is, like, constantly unveiling itself to me in new ways. Because this is very close to a perfect script. Like, the tone, the consistency, the timing, everything about it, the way that it plants things for payoff later. One of the things I caught this time is like, okay, Heather Chandler, we never see her by herself except in one scene. Do you remember?
Is that where she's alone with the jock?
Well, it's right after that.
Oh, she's in the bathroom mirror.
Yeah,
and
she's in the bathroom
spits
mirror.
At herself.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, part of the joke of this movie is that society thrusts upon everyone in this movie, based on the information that they learn, has some kind of like revelation, whether it be fake or it be real, whether it's the news, the yearbook kid who wants to make sure that he gets a video of this like love-in thing so that he can use it for his Stanford application. And I guess, you know, this is as good a time as any to mention the musical, which I have seen and I do love.
Which is rare.
Yeah, it's very rare that I enjoy a very straightforward musical, and this one is one. And before we signed off last week from talking with each other, I mentioned that I was going to try and find like maybe someone's uploaded filming of their own like production of the stage musical to YouTube and maybe see if I could find that and put it in our chat so that, you know, we could skim through it before we talked about it. But the thing is, every single one of them is recorded on somebody's phone and has the worst sound. And I was just like, I can't. This is such like a misrepresentation of what I have seen. And I did see it with its original cast almost 10 years ago in May of 2014 off Broadway. I actually went to New York to see this musical because this is my favorite movie. And there are things in the musical that I think work. Like if you're like me and your algorithm is very like the algorithm knows how much you love Heathers. Anytime there's some young musical fan who's like, oh my God, I just watched Heathers the musical and then I watched the movie and now I'm going to do a comparison. The algorithm recommends that to me. And I'm often very frustrated that younger theater fans have a preference for the musical over the movie because the movie is so special and important to me.
Hairspray effect.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like this movie is so iconic to me and I understand why they love the musical, and I guess I just have to accept that they love something Heathers, even if they don't love original Heathers as much as they love the musical, like you said. And a couple of things that I'll go ahead and bring up that the musical does differently is that it combines Betty and Martha into one character, which I don't like.
Yeah, I don't like that.
I understand the need to condense some characters for the sake of the stage, but they keep the Martha name, which totally like gets rid of this lovely connection between Betty and Veronica, where both, you know, their first names are Betty and Veronica, like in Jughead comics, and their last names are Finn and Sawyer, like Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. Like that's explicit, in this screenplay that is something that when they combine those characters in the musical, they lose that connection. I don't really love that.
You don't remember beloved Archie character Dump Truck? He used to hang out with Jughead a lot.
Oh, you mean Dunstock?
Yeah.
I'll also say they include Heather Chandler in the narrative much more later than the film does. And they're able to do that because of the way that theater works. And I really enjoy that, which is that essentially Heather Chandler, she does not appear in the film after she dies, obviously, except in this one nightmare sequence whenever Heather is dreaming, Veronica is dreaming about being forced to kill Heather Duke by JD. But in the musical, in the stage musical, she reappears to sing the parts of the letter that are, of course, Veronica's like forgery of a suicide note. And what's interesting in the musical, and I think it's here in the film as well, but maybe not as explicit, is that like people have really important and like major revelations about themselves as they observe this tragedy. But because they believe that it's suicide, the things that they are perceiving are actually false. Like they're having these like true realizations about themselves based entirely upon lies, lies told by just two people. And it's really fascinating to see that play out in the musical. And then I'll say that the I love my dead gay son scene, which I think is very funny, or at least used to, I think that that was actually kind of ruined by the musical, because that that song is the opening number of Act Two. And, you know, it's the one where everybody's, you're trying to re-energize everybody after they just went and like took a piss, right?
Broadway tradition.
Yeah.
The group piss.
Taking a piss. off Broadway, even. But, you know, you come back from intermission, you have this big Act Two opening number. And it is, I think, my least favorite number in the whole production, because I know that it's funny that they have these two fathers of these two, you know, boys who have been framed as participating in like a lover's suicide pact. And then they start talking about how they love their dead gay sons. And then, you know, oh, remember that one time that you and I had kind of a broke back thing. And it's like, why is this here? Like, it doesn't actually contribute to the narrative of any of the characters that we know. Those two actors are mostly part of like the chorus for the rest of it. So that's something that I don't love in the musical, is that as a bridging number. And it kind of has ruined the fun of the original scene for me.
I mean, kudos to them for successfully staging a Heather's follow-up at all, though, because, you know, famously there has been attempts to revive it as a TV show several times recently. And basically every time they wanted to launch it, there was another school shooting in America and it would be delayed for, you know, tasteful reasons. And maybe it shouldn't be remade. Like, you know, this is a pre-Columbine property. Yeah. Not very to say there was never school violence, but, you know.
Yeah. JD fake shoots those boys in the school cafeteria. And goes after to school, everyone's just like giggling, like, he won't be expelled.
Yeah. But also, like, that is, you know, since the 80s, things have changed that much. But in the 2000s, Mean Girls is a very similar touchstone for a later generation than us. And they can't even remake that one as mean as it was in 2004. Like,
right.
They did a Mean Girls remake as a musical this year. Mm-hmm. And that was very toned down. From what I read, I didn't actually watch it. It looked really bad. But from what I read, not only were the songs not very good, but the jokes were like defanged. And a lot of like the meanness of it was kind of sanded down. And I don't think that it's impossible to make a mean high school comedy now. I've seen a couple that have like a Heather's tinge to them that I appreciate. It's just that, you know, these properties, as they get more popular, they have to reach a wider audience, so they get a little sanitized and they get a little scrubbed. And it always feels like we're referring back to this as the central text. Even something as like bubbly and fun as Clueless, you're still thinking of Heather's in the back of your mind. And that was just a few years out.
Right.
I think ultimately the way that happened, and this is a discovery for me on this watch, because I watched the commentary track, was that it was written to be the end all be all, like the final word in high school movies. It was supposed to encapsulate right. the entire high school movie genre in one picture. And the way Daniel Waters went about writing this was as a, it was still satirical and like coldly funny, but he wrote it as a 3-hour movie to be directed by Stanley Kubrick.
Really?
He did
what
not
a great
get his way,
way to write this movie.
And you kind of see it a little bit in the kind of the eerie tone. There's a lot of scenes where you can't tell if you're actually watching a dream sequence or if it is real life. I think right. a little bit of that Kubrickian coldness still seeps in.
Uh-huh.
Also in the like Clockwork Orange style like language that these kids make up, where they're yes. not exactly doing Valley Girl speak. It is its own weird thing. Like it's just a made up language. Yeah.
How very, you're beautiful. Got a motor if I'm going to make it to this funeral on time.
Yeah. But I think the way it really shows is not in any of the stuff that was like left over like that. Like not any of the Kubrick touches, really. It's more in that it was a 3-hour script that other collaborators came down on and like honed in on what worked, edited. Like that is the heart of writing is editing. And mm-hmm. it's so densely overwritten. You can kind of feel it straining to get all the good bits out within yes. the allotted time.
Yes.
Like everything is so densely packed in there. It can only be a work that was written as an epic and then edited down to its essential parts. And something that's written to be a 90-minute comedy is going to have a much harder time. Or even the way most comedies are made now, where there's like, it's very lightly written and there's room left for actors to kind of like riff on set. And they kind of just take the best take out of whatever 10 they get that day. This movie is so overwritten, so close to the script, because the script had been like perfected by this little trio of young upstarts who like wanted to make the final word in high school movies. And I think they achieved yeah, that goal. I'm always did. Thinking of this.
I think it's interesting though, to have something overwritten and then edited down that constantly references Moby Dick.
Yeah.
A famously extremely long book.
That was another discovery. Is it was supposed to be Catcher in the Rye, and the Salinger, famously litigious Salinger family, would not yeah. allow it, which is very annoying because Catcher in the Rye makes more sense. Moby Dick just feels like a weird joke.
I think yeah. that it being Moby Dick does make it funnier.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. you know, it tells us something about Heather Duke, which is that she has... persistence, right? Like, as sort of the immediate beta, to use these outdated and unscientific terms, the immediate beta of Heather Chandler, to be put upon all the time, to constantly be asked, did you have a brain tumor for breakfast? First of all, you asked if you could be red, when you know I'm always red.
Or asked to be a table so Veronica could sign papers on her back.
Yes.
She yes. bends over.
God, and she ran to so many news stations. But that she has a persistence to her that even though she pretty immediately falls into the trap of being as evil as Heather Chandler when she falls as the first head of this Hydra, that... the fact that she is not just that she's reading Moby Dick, but that she's still reading it, like that she doesn't give up on it, does tell you something about her character. Or again, I might be reading something that's like not necessarily there in the text just because I've interacted with this text so many times.
Well, I mean, death of the author, no matter what reason they put it in the picture, like its yeah. effect is out of their hands. I'm sorry to be the IMDb trivia page section of this podcast today, but that's my job right now.
Yes.
One thing that also was very funny was that Shannon Doherty did not know that this was a comedy until she watched it in the theater, and she was very upset. She was like, I played that role as Heather Duke very seriously. I thought this was like my dramatic breakout, and she did not gel with the tone. She thought this like was kind of distasteful comedy because it's like darker and funnier than she wanted it to be, and I think over time, and like as she sat with it and became an adult, she like came around to it, the exact opposite of Winona Ryder, who like was gung-ho about this project.
Yeah. Oh,
I love her. Winona Ryder is so good, and
she owns this role.
She
this
does. Is
she fought for it.
Yeah. This is her iconic role to me, like in a career of iconic movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, I cannot pick one, but yes.
I just always picture her at a writing desk.
With the monocle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
they're going to have to send her SAT scores to San Quentin instead of Stanford.
I love her psychotic serial killer handwriting, too.
I was going to say, her handwriting is absolutely unhinged, and
she's getting
11
words to a page.
Yes.
It's like, it's really absurd. Oh, I love her nightstand with the punctuation mark dresser pulls.
Mm-hmm. Something you can only pull off as a teenager. Like, it seems like it's been in her bedroom since she was like 12, and she just kind of stuck with it.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring something up, and, you know, you're going to apologize for being the IMDb, like, trivia page, but I want to apologize as the person who keeps accidentally reading, like, really relevant books, but I've been reading this book about Beatrice Sparks and Go Ask Alice and how that book was, like, a fake, and part of it is that during this time period, like, these teen books that this woman wrote about troubled teens and them committing suicide, like, were so popular and, like, started, like, the panic over drugs and contributed to the satanic panic. And I can't help but think, like, a teen writing in a diary about a movie that's about teen suicide, like, I can't think that this wasn't referencing something like Go Ask Alice. Like, it is fascinating to me, especially because that would have been around the same time. And I recommend the book Unmasking Alice because it's fascinating.
I'm not going to discount that because obviously, you know, if they're writing this in that time, you know, it would have been a hot topic. But the explanation they gave is that there were local news stories about like rashes of suicide.
Yes.
Where like the same high school, if there was one suicide, there would be like several kind of copycat, like inspired by suicide.
I mean,
that was like a real news story.
Well, it is, you know, a real statistic. It's like if someone around you commits suicide, like you're more likely to, like, especially if it's a friend or a close person.
And I guess the satire of the movie is less about the reasons why someone would do that. It's not targeting the kids for feeling suicidal. It kind of takes it as a given that like life sucks and the world is stacked against you and it's just hard to be alive. It's more that the phony reactions to the suicide and the way it changes everyone's perception of the person.
What are you talking about? You hated her. She hated you.
Yeah. Winona Ryder talked in an interview about like someone at her high school killed herself and she was like mercilessly bullied. And then afterwards, everyone was talking about how that was like their best friend. And that was like one of the reasons she was drawn to the project was like, I lived this. I saw it. Yeah. It is like a very tough subject. It is like remarkably brave that they made a movie about it, given that like, they could have been blamed for there being like suicides after the movie, saying that they were inspired by it, which I think is partially why the movie is somewhat corrupted by studio notes in that the movie was supposed to end on everyone blowing up in that high school pep rally. And then in heaven, they all get along finally.
Yeah.
Like, now that they're all dead, everything's fine. And they all are like, there's no more cliques.
Instead, we get that one line about how the only place different social people will get along is in heaven.
So the idea still gets across. And I do like that Looney Tunes ending where Veronica lights her cigarette off of JD as he blows himself up outside the school. I think that's a very funny moment. And Martha Dumptruck's little choreography with her wheelchair around Veronica.
They just doing donuts.
Cute. I don't dislike the ending as it is, but I do sometimes think about that like perfect prom in heaven ending, you know, with a bigger budget and with like full studio support. It could have been a real like all-time classic ending to a film.
As someone who's had a lot of time to like think about that alternate ending in all the many times that I've watched this, because of course every time I watch it I also read everything I can about it, and that's sort of one of the big trivia facts that everybody, you know, is mostly aware of online, is that the original ending was darker and had that element of, you know, everyone getting along in heaven. And in fact, that comes through more in the dialogue and the songwriting in the musical. It's more hinted at. But I think that it works better as like, you know, a remonstration against JD's belief in that in the end. I don't know. I think that I do prefer this to the original ending, even though I might have said something different even just like 10 years ago.
The cut ending, the original ending as it was scripted, is more irresponsible. And I think it would have played into that real life tragedy in a grotesque way. But just in terms of like art and storytelling, like It is something fun to be wistful about, but I wouldn't change the way the movie is, you know? I think it's perfectly good and maybe even like more morally centered without celebrating suicide as the answer to all these kids' problems, you know?
Yeah.
Right. And there is something really telling about like the fact that this lie was able to lead to a couple of near tragedies, right? In the same way that, like, you know, this rash of real life suicides that we're talking about, like the reportage on that, the way that it made more people aware of it, could have been a contributing factor. Because this one, you know, there are two characters who attempt suicide as a result of it being treated so weirdly by adults. Like, it's not like they talk around the seriousness of it a lot.
Well, yeah, because deciding whether or not to kill yourself is the most important decision of a teenager's life.
Yeah.
Call me when the shuttle lands, Pauline. But yeah, it's really beautiful, actually, when Veronica bursts in and stops Heather McNamara from, you know, trying to overdose on baby aspirin just to become a fucking statistic in USA Today. And then, you know, Martha throws herself in front of a vehicle and it's actually like really, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah.
This sort of inspiration comes entirely from falsehood. And what's really happening is that, like, there's a new guy in town and he's a bad boy, but he's not just a bad boy. He's a bad man. And, you know, he has convinced this like very smart, but very bored young woman to join him in a murder spree by making her think that that's not what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
It's a great cautionary tale about not falling for the wrong fuck boy, you know?
And I mean, even if it's not a cautionary tale, it's still scarily relevant. And in that way, I was going to ask, like, do we count this as a horror movie? Because there are some really horrific things going on here.
And it was on Shudder at one point.
Yeah.
Like mine's, I guess. there are scenes that are straight up horror, like Veronica's nightmare where she has to kill Heather number three. And JD takes her to the kitchen and like wipes off the knife with his sleeve and she sees her own reflection in the knife and like thinks about all the violence she's caused. Like that is shot like a slasher.
Yeah. And there's so much like, you know, giallo lighting going on.
Yeah.
Or at least Suspiria lighting.
And there's a lot of like dreamy framing, even when it's not a dream. You know, there are several scenes where you're not really sure which reality you're in until you're grounded.
And in fact, it starts the movie that way because are not meant to take it literally that Veronica is buried in her garden having the other girls hit croquet balls at her.
Yeah.
So it tells you right from the start that there's going to be an element of surreality. And I will say the sort of dream sequence for Heather Duke where everybody is wearing the 3D glasses.
That's, oh my God.
It's very funny and it looks cool, but in its way, it's also very creepy.
It's real spooky.
Apparently they were all supposed to be wearing like nice sunglasses, but they found the 3D glasses like cheaper for the production. And then it like worked so well visually. They were like really pleased with it.
Oh yeah. This would not be as good if it were just like sunglasses. The 3D glasses make it that much more like surreal.
What's interesting about the horror aspect though, is that the first, I want to say 40 minutes, you would never know. Like you said, there were like the opening prepares you for it. And there's like little like dreamlike touches throughout. Even the music and the lunchtime poll in the cafeteria has a kind of dreamy.
So ethereal.
Yeah. But it's not until like a good 40 minutes of the movie that Heather Chandler is murdered. And then you're like, oh, I'm not watching a John Hughes movie. I'm watching something much more sinister. And their teen angst bullshit is going to have a body count. You know, like the kind of thriller aspects of it, if not the horror aspects, arrive pretty late in the runtime. And then it just kind of amps up from there and just never stops until the end.
Yeah.
I'm pretty loose with the term horror.
Me too. So, yeah.
I never feel like gatekeeping what isn't and what isn't horror. I think the value of that genre is that it does put butts in seats. Like it is an easy way to sell a movie. And it also gives writers and directors a lot of free space to play with the form, a lot of free space to like ignore reality and reach for something beyond the rules of like regular logic in a way that audiences are willing to go along with. And I would say there is a way in which the horror aspects of this movie free it up to do exactly that. So it is using horror at least for what it's good for, in my eyes. Not necessarily to scare you, but like to free you from real world logic long enough to like be able to do its own thing beyond the real world.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I realized like, oh, maybe I do like horror movies is I was talking to one of my friends and, you know, they were just kind of like, well, you know, horror doesn't always have to be scary. Sometimes it can just be eerie. Like sometimes it could just be creepy.
Sometimes there are eyes without a face, Allie.
Oh, yeah, sometimes. And yeah, I think about that a lot when I think about like horror and things like this, when it's like, because I think that's the other thing that I like about this movie and many movies I like is it's like a cross genre thing. Like there is no really like, you know, we're talking about this being like a teen movie and a teen comedy, but like, it's very, very difficult to still like try and put this movie in a neat little genre box.
I will say this. If the litmus test is, would I throw this on during Halloween season? The answer is no, I would not. But
yeah,
I do think if Daniel Waters was trying to write the end all be all final word in the high school movie, you kind of have to do a little bit of like slasher stuff in there. And this movie pretty sincerely engages with that end of the genre.
I concur.
I also want to say that I love that they keep talking about prom, but they never show the prom. Unlike many other teen movies. The prom is just mentioned. Like, it's never shown.
Yeah, Big Fun was supposed to play prom in heaven.
Yeah, teen suicide. Don't do it.
I'm trying to imagine who would play Big Fun in the movie. Would it be like Oingo Boingo or...
No, I don't know. It's the band from Starstruck.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
I imagine them as Big Fun.
Yeah.
I will tell you, there is not a song called Teenage Suicide, open parentheses, don't do it, close parentheses, in Heather's the Musical. But there is a song just called Big Fun. It's fine.
That's a little disappointing. It's
maybe
right
it's a
there.
Licensing issue. Like, they couldn't, do it because it's actually, like, recording from the movie. It would have cost more if it been.
Teenage Suicide. Don't do it. Teenage Suicide.
Don't do it. Oh, you know what? You know what phrase I actually do use probably from this movie most? It's having a sword fight in my mouth.
I could see how that would come up.
Yeah.
I have a question. Should we watch Hudson Hawk?
I would be more open to yeah, we should.
Okay.
I was gonna say Ford Fairlane, but you're right, we should do Hudson Hawk.
So Ford Fairlane was also written by Daniel Waters.
Right.
Who also wrote this movie called Vampire Academy that looks awful, but I really want to see it. It's just like other high school movie.
That sounds like a paranormal romance book. So
it's like YA, I think like 2010s, like straight to video schlock. It looks
perfect. It is bad, paranormal
romance. It's not a theatrical release, and it came out in 2014. Yeah. I'm ashamed to say that I know.
Okay. But Hudson Hawk was his other collaboration with the director of Heathers, I think pretty soon after. It's not very well reviewed in its time, but I think it has, you know, like every VHS era movie has its defenders now. I think it has people that like stand up for it. So I don't know. Just throwing that out there.
I've seen enough Moonlighting in the past year to be like really interested in that part of Bruce Willis's career, like that time period.
Yeah. Oh, I stand corrected. I'm fact checking myself in real time. Mark Waters directed Vampire Academy.
Yes, but Daniel wrote it.
Oh no, it's both of them.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, it has to be seen to be believed.
Yeah. Interesting that he also wrote or co-wrote Batman Returns.
Classic.
Obvious in retrospect, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yes.
The best Batman movie to date. No shade to the People's Joker, which is definitely up there for me as well.
No, I don't disagree.
We all know that for me, it's Under the Red Hood, but Batman Returns has a really big place in my heart. It's way up there.
I think we might be the only group of people that's like, yeah, Batman Returns. It's great.
I'm sure if you polled every S&M dungeon in the nation.
I mean, you know, we have a lot of overlap in our favorite movies with them. Let's be real.
That was definitely my, like, pointing at the screen, like an excited child moments in The People's Joker, where all the Batman Returns references. I'm sure I was missing a lot of Batman stuff, but I did not miss any of those. I did hear you say earlier, Boomer, that this is a nearly perfect film.
Yeah.
You said it's a nearly perfect screenplay.
Nearly.
All right, well.
What's holding you back?
So there's a lot of pairing in this movie, which I really love. You know, there's a lot of, like, duos. Because you've got Heather and the way that she interacts with JD, but you also have, like, you know, you have this Kurt and Ram pairing, and you have this parental pairing, and then you have these, like, officers who are, like, yin and yang with each other. For some reason, there are two teachers. We have our former hippie, who is the first one to be like, no, we really need to, like, engage with this moment whenever Heather Chandler's supposed suicide occurs. And in that scene, there's another teacher named Paul. And I don't know why you would put a Paul and a Pauline in a scene together if they're not supposed to be, like, mirrors of one another. So yeah, when I say nearly perfect, my lack of perfection is very pedantic.
We need to get our hands on that 3-hour version and see what Paul and Pauline's deal was.
Yeah.
That's the remake we need. We don't need a musical version of Mean Girls. We need a full 3-hour Heather's adaptation of whatever Daniel Waters wrote in the first place, just to really see every detail.
Yeah. I will say, if you want more Heathers, Heathers the musical is really good. It's really good. And I say that as someone who, like, you know, generally hates musicals of this exact type. And in fact, you know, as someone who was ready to really dislike it for potentially ruining what has been for many years my favorite movie, it's good. It holds up.
Can I ask you, besides the writing of this, what makes it your favorite movie?
So I find it very funny. I find it very witty, but that's the writing that you're talking about. There's something about the way that it comes together to be more than just the sum of its parts. You mentioned, like, the music and its kind of ethereality, and it does have this, like, very beautiful 80s synthesizer heaven thing going on, which is another reason that you kind of think that maybe the movie is going to go there with everyone dying at the end. You know, you believe that JD might blow this school up. You know,
definitely.
You don't actually.
Yes.
it's not like one of those movies where at the end you're like, oh, of course, the, you know, Ethan Hunt and his team are going to get out of this somehow. It's what's going to be exciting is seeing how they do it. It's like, no, this school might actually be like a smoking cinder by the time that the credits roll. And the way that that sort of electronic, like, there's something about the sound mix on streaming sites, where I did watch this on streaming because I was on the road, that the music is not, it's pitched way down in the sound on streaming sites as opposed to having it on the DVD. But there's this very particular, like, almost sort of bamboo pipe sound. This, like, dun, 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 that's electronic.
Yeah.
That, you know, is really good. The music in this one, it's so 80s, but it's also transcendent of that time period as well. And it's, like, the perfect combination with what this movie's tone is, because it kind of keeps you on your feet until, like you said, it becomes more of a thriller at the 40-minute mark.
I do want to say the visuals of it are pretty densely detailed as well.
Yes.
It's hard to tell how much of it scripted. I do know the way that the Heathers were color-coded. Like, each Heather has a dominant color in their outfits.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the script.
Yeah.
But, like, there are other decisions that I'm not as sure about. And I'm thinking particularly of the scene where Veronica and JD are arguing in the cow field, and we're watching Heather number 3 basically get date raped in the background. And it's just, like, uncommented upon. And it is one of those moments that could play as too cruel if it was, like, purely a joke. But I want to say that scene, much like the homophobia and the teen suicide, is much more complicated than mocking it. It's like just a sad moment that's just kind of happening and is par for the course. And yeah. I want to say date rape comes up enough as a topic elsewhere in the film that it's not just like a throwaway gag. Date rape is as prominent in the script as the homophobia and the suicide.
Yeah.
But that moment where that's just kind of happening in the corner of the frame, and then we're watching this argument in the forefront, and there's a fourth character who's, or a fifth character who's passed out drunk.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in that one shot. And even still, there's stuff I notice. I've seen this movie dozens of times. And like, I don't know that I ever paid as much attention to the graphic design of the Snappy Snack Shack neon sign as I did this time, where I was like, why isn't that on like t-shirts at every Target, the way that, like, you know,
right.
Whatever.
There's one in Baton Rouge, he says.
Yeah. I did hear that.
Yeah, there's one in Baton Rouge.
Or even her slushie that they get at the Snap Shack is like comically oversized. Like, no slushie has ever been in that big of a cup. And it's just really funny how it like dwarfs her and looks kind of like it would be drawn on a page of Archie comics and not something you could purchase in real life. Like, there's a lot of visual touches to it that, I do think it is kind of more the sum of its parts in some ways. Like you were saying, like, there's kind of a magic to the collaboration here, especially between the producer, director, and writer. Like, I feel like these are three people on a scrappy budget. This was an independent film that really pulled something really special together that, honestly, I don't know that any of them ever topped later in their careers. Maybe Batman is a close second for me, but Heathers, I think, is a better film. Yeah, it just is something really special.
There are a lot of visual touches that we haven't talked about yet. I love that the Dean family stereo system is like Flintstonesy.
I was going to say, it's like faux rock going on for, you know, all that rock and roll they listen to.
And they haul that around from state to state too.
Yeah.
Clunky stereo.
Big Daddy Dean has a huge weight set. And we see him like exercising.
But other than that, their house looks like real bare and like
two bachelors. You know?
We got to leave room for the bomb making studios. They both have their own private quarters.
Very true.
That's true. The pan from Heather Chandler about to perform fellatio on that college student that moves towards the Maxell poster.
That's a funny gag.
It has the potential to be so corny, but in this movie, it does work.
That was not in the script. Daniel Waters was mad about it at first, and then he's like, you know what? That's funny. Never mind.
I love that a flaming alcoholic drink gets knocked out of the window into the trash can.
That's just so it looks cool. Like,
yes.
It's just used for a practical in that one scenario, and it makes me so happy. I was like, this is the best practical.
What do you mean by practical? Like practical lighting?
Yeah, like a practical lighting thing. Like a
light source?
Yeah. So, you know, in movies, if there's like a light source and you're supposed to, like, the lighting, the scene is supposed to be that light source. That's the practical is
it's
so
that she can have her verbal showdown with Heather Chandler in the alley as fire plays across their faces. And she says, lick it up, baby. Lick it up. Transfer to Washington. Transfer to Jefferson. Come Monday morning, you'll be a pariah. Sorry, go on.
No, that is one of the best lines in the movie, the lick it up line. Yeah. I think about that a lot.
Yes.
Save the speeches for Malcolm X. I just want to get laid.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Do y'all know that quote from the Lord of the Rings cinematographer where someone was pestering him on set about like lighting somebody unnaturally and there was no light source sighted in the scene. And someone was like, where's the light coming from in this scene? If you're lighting his face that way.
Oh my God.
And he was like, the same place the music is coming from. We're making a fucking movie. Like, this is not
reality. God. I love that guy because he also was the cinematographer for Babe, and you can tell.
That's great.
Two movies that are lit like very similar. I love it.
I've been thinking about that quote a lot lately because I'm watching The Sopranos, and like all TV now is like so dark because it's so hyper real and so mired in logic that like I'm watching this show where there's people sitting in their car alone at night making phone calls, and they have a perfect spotlight on their face so I can see their lips moving, and I'm like, yes, we used to like make real art.
Yeah,
we used to just accept that, like, you want to see the character, and the character can be lit in a dramatic way without it needing to be realistic. And I think that like, is why that scene is especially funny to me with the trash can lighting, because at no other point in the movie do we feel the need to, like, have a very realistic, like, lighting source. Like, it just feels like another one of those gags where it's like, this movie is totally surreal, but this moment, shit just got real.
It's a realistic source, but also it's like a Rube Goldberg setup to get there,
yeah,
in a way that, like,
yeah,
it becomes a metatextual joke.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll excuse it in this case, both because it looks cool and because it's so funny.
Yeah.
And its own kind of self-parody.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, it's so that they can have, you know, a fight by firelight, you know, it's,
yeah,
gotta, they could light it like there was just a fire in the alley, but they didn't, they went above and beyond, and that's what I really love.
It does play in the date rape theme of the film as well, too. It's like her drink was spiked with something.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why it caught fire so extravagantly.
And also why she feels horrible.
Yeah, she feels ill.
I love the conversation that Veronica has with her mother. The one right after her father is like, I don't patronize bunny rabbits. And then her mother is like, you know, listen up, young lady. Most of the time when teenagers want to be treated like human beings, it's because they are being treated like human beings. And that was a line that has changed in meaning so much as I myself have become an adult. Because, you know, I was a teenager in love with this movie. Like, you know, I wanted to be Veronica. I would make different decisions than she did, but I wanted to be her. And now that I'm older, it's like, yeah, actually, your concerns, like, outside of the context of, like, you know, all of her stuff going on with JD, she does seem to be kind of shallow, even mm-hmm. though she's the brightest one, because that's what her life has become. She uses her genius IQ to pick out, you know, shades of lipstick or whatever it is that she says, you know? And I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this movie, for all of its, like, surreality, still gets, like, being a teenager right. You know, you have priorities, and those priorities aren't always the most thought out. Like, of course her priorities are shallow. Like, she doesn't have to worry about paying for a house and, like,
right.
buying her own food, and yeah.
And I think we see that in the scene that she has with Betty when Betty comes over and plays croquet with her.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she hits Betty's ball playing croquet, and Betty's like, okay, why don't you take, you know, the shot? Why don't you go ahead and knock me out? Which is one of the rules of croquet, is that if you hit another ball, you can move your ball next to it, and then sort of through the transference of energy with your foot on your ball, knock them out of play. And Veronica is just like, yeah, that's not my way. And Betty's like, but it is the only way to win. And so Veronica does it. Like, she's won over by that statement very quickly. And it does speak to how, even though she is, like, the smartest person among her peers in many ways, she's also still really influenced. And she thinks that she's above the influence because she's among the Heathers. And so she sees them for what they really are. And it's like they're people who work together and their job is being popular and shit. She still remains very influenced by them and even just by Betty and what people want of her. And that really comes to the fore when she allows herself to be misled very stupidly by JD about the Ikaluga bullets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to end by asking if there is one movie, I'm going to limit you to one, I'm thinking of it in real time, so I'm stalling, that you think might have, like, picked up the mantle best. Like, what's the best follow-up to Heathers that, like, gets us close to the perfect tonal tightrope walk that we were talking about earlier?
Hmm.
And so that you can stall for time as well, I'll just name the one that came to mind as I was asking that question, which I think is maybe Drop Dead Gorgeous. I think that one, it oversteps a few times, especially with Will Sasso's character and with the previous winner, who is a bulimic kind of prom queen type.
Yeah.
But I think generally the sort of small town viciousness of that film and the sort of flippant satire about commodifying these, like, teen girls' beauty for this, you know, advertisement campaign.
Right.
I think it captures that, like, flippantly cruel, but also, like, satirically on target tone from Heathers. And of course, Kirsten Dunst, like one of the greatest teen stars of all time, holds down the sentimentality in a very authentic way as well, where you want to root for her. She's like a real character amongst all the very ridiculous people she has to deal with on a day-to-day basis in that movie.
I love that one. Yeah. I'm going to give you my real answer. And it's going to be, I think, a little bit of a surprise. But so first, I'll mention the things that I think are generally considered to be of that ilk and which I would agree with. You know, Jawbreaker, Mean Girls, those are the obvious ones. If we are talking about conceptually, if we're talking about the way that teens treat each other, the way that like sex is used as violence between teenagers, if we're talking about small town meanness, if we're talking about snappy dialogue, I think the answer is Jennifer's Body.
I buy that. I'd also throw, if those are the qualifications, I'd also throw Bottoms in the mix as well.
Oh, very much so. I think we even said that whenever I mentioned that I had seen it a little bit ago. And what's really funny is that Bottoms made me think a lot of Strangers with Candy, which we talked about briefly. Yeah. And throughout this movie, even though I've seen it, you know, as many times, too many times to count, I also kept thinking about how much I wanted to rewatch that Strangers with Candy finale that Winona Ryder is in, where she has that moment where she has a cigarette in her right hand, she takes a drag, and then she flicks it, and then her hand comes back from out of frame with another cigarette. And I'm like, that is the coolest that a human being has ever been.
I'll have to drag out my awful Trapper Keeper DVD case of that series and rewatch the finale. One of the worst designs for a DVD case ever, and I've replaced it several times because the discs crack, but worth replacing because it also happens to be the greatest television show of all time, and it's worth the multiple purchases.
But yeah, I think Jennifer's Body would be the one that I would say comes the closest to capturing Heather's and all of its perfect imperfections.
Speaking of Jennifer's Body... the new Diablo Cody script for Lisa Frankenstein also has very strong Heather's energy in its plotting. The way that character gets their revenge on high school slights through this like zombie they resurrect is very Heather's in concept. And the jokes are very funny. They're very overwritten. Diablo Cody, I'm guessing, came up watching Heather's just based on how she makes up fake teen slang.
She loves to overwrite.
Yeah.
Like in the same vein as Heather's. That's true.
And I think that really works in Jennifer's Body. I don't know that Lisa Frankenstein fully nails it, but it's not really her fault. I think the movie's just edited oddly, and a lot of the jokes are kind of like left in dead air and just don't land the way they should. But I will say that does carry over to her work generally. Sometimes embarrassingly so. I think that Rainn Wilson scene in Juno has done a lot of disservice to her work aging well in the public consciousness. But in general, I think she does bring like Heather's energy into most of her projects in a way that I appreciate.
I guess if I want to make one more dark horse recommendation, there's an episode of the horror anthology show Into the Dark entitled New Year, New You, where each of these episodes are basically their film length. That one was directed by Sophia Takal, and it stars like Sookie Waterhouse and Kirby Howell-Baptiste. And I think that one has a lot of Heather's energy if you just need more of this. It doesn't really come close. It doesn't have the same funniness, but it does have some of the same meanness. And the way that this film treats teen suicide, that film treats like social media fame desire. So I would give that one a recommendation as well.
I love how I was trying to get like one answer and it gets spiraled out, which I think is generally how this show works.
It was never going to happen. Yeah. It was never going to happen that way.
Let me throw out a few more. I already referenced Sugar and Spice, the cheerleaders rob the bank comedy, which if you think Heather's is irresponsible with its homophobic slurs, that movie will take you on a ride.
Yes, it's indeed.
Surprisingly homophobic, but it's very funny. I'd also throw out a couple more recent ones. I'm thinking specifically of The Edge of 17 and Spontaneous, which are a little more serious. They kind of touch on that YA dramatic angle a little more than most of the comedies we're mentioning, but they're both start off very mean in a way that felt purely Heather's. And especially Edge of 17, like that one, the main character, you're supposed to realize the reason that they're an outsider after a while and the reason they feel so lonely and isolated from their peers is like partly because of their personality. And that's like a hard lesson that like you have to learn about Veronica as well. Like she is not a perfect role model of like teen behavior.
No. Edge of 17 is like that bit from 30 Rock where Liz realizes that she was the bully in high school.
Definitely, yes.
Like stretched out to full length. And look, you're never going to get me to side against Kira Sedgwick. I'm sorry. That ain't never going to happen. I guess if we're going to do one more, if we're going to do one more recommendation.
One more.
Bodies, 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 actually.
Just one more thing.
Yeah,
has some Heather's energy, especially in the way that like these girls who are supposedly friends are actually like really horrifically cruel to each other in ways that are very biting in both their wit and like their damage.
Yeah.
And that also revolves around an apparent, like, you know, you don't find out until the end what really happened, but there does appear to be a murderer amongst them. So if Heather's has like horror thriller vibes through the, you know, lens of like catty teenage killing, then Bodies, Bodies, Bodies is just as much a horror movie as Heather's is. Cause in that one, you don't know who the supposed killer is.
Yeah. And Rachel Sennett's character in particular, like the satire of like her being this like empty headed podcaster who's like very oblivious about the ways that like her privilege show, I don't know, like she feels like a Heather's character just up to the 2020s.
Yes,
I would even say this movie's on my mind when I'm watching Clueless, just in how specific the Valley Girl vernacular in that movie is. It's similarly overwritten, but also it just is like one of the perfect high school comedies. Like it's just like perfectly constructed in a way that I don't know that any other movie could match it besides Heather's. Like,
yeah.
Those two films just feel like kind of untouchable in my mind as like the greatest movies in that genre.
I think, you know, Clueless is softer. It's nicer.
It is. It's nicer. But I don't even know that I can cite those as being greats with any objectivity because those were just the movies that were available in home video when I was in high school, you know? Like,
yeah.
Whenever I think back to my favorite movies in that genre, it can't be a coincidence that most of them came out in the late 90s. A lot of them in 1999 specifically.
Well, okay. You know the one, because I was thinking about it earlier, is Craft. The Craft has like similar vibes and like this teen girl rivalry, like gone awry and people taking things too far in the name of like trying to be the head bitch.
Their teen angst bullshit has a body count then.
It does.
Cannot be discounted. A rip in my family. I can't use the car. I gotta be